jumping the gun there a bit.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the 40K Fireside Podcast. I'm David Gaylor, and I'm joined by my good friend, Vic Vijay. Together, we discuss 40K in the meta from our perspective, along with events we've recently been to and those that have got coming up. So come on down to the fireside and listen.
Come on down and listen, episode 51. And this is going to be a great episode. Gives me great pleasure to introduce the current and will be for the next year reigning Oxford Supermajor champion, Vic Vijay. Vic, congratulations on the weekend.
Thanks, Dave. Got one.
Scoop a little 260 player.
You decided to take a break and let someone else win one for once. So I managed to have a good run at Oxford and take that one down with the Adeptus Sororitas.
Yeah. Actually, that makes me regret playing because we could have been in the finals together maybe before a change.
you subbed in Nassim in the finals.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But congratulations on the weekend. It was a good turnout for an event, as we kind of covered in the last episode. What were your, should we just delve right into it? Should we just start off round one? What were you up against? Because I think nothing's changed for me since last week. So I reckon we should just run through
all your bearings. People should probably listen to the last episode. We didn't put that out too far back. Yep. And that kind of goes through an overview of everything. But just if people hadn't seen that episode, this is a 251 person super major. So it's five rounds cutting to a top four for a total of seven rounds if you want to go all the way to the end. Yep. Oxford is located so well, Dave. The connection links are so easy for everyone.
Yeah.
That I think that was a big factor in a lot of people coming to attend this event.
Yep.
But interestingly, a lot of the top players that you'd usually see winning these tournaments weren't in attendance. Mm-hmm. So it was a weird, interesting kind of mix of people there. And I really enjoyed seeing lots of different people across the top tables having a great time.
Yep.
I'd highly recommend this one in the future. The venue was very, very good. Location was great.
Oh, awesome. It's been a little bit of rough patches for the UKTC in terms of venues recently, so it's nice to have some resounding positive feedback on that one.
Yeah, I was getting a bit worried that the events were dipping down to the 100-person mark.
Yeah.
But I'm glad to see, you know, that there is still interest there for big super majors, and 251 people is awesome.
Yeah, and you know, on that point, it's kind of interesting that to have such a big tournament so late into kind of the staleness of the meta, right, so to speak. So that's an interesting point, you know. So it just goes to show that if you are a TO, you know, perhaps, because I think, you know, Vic and I over the past, whatever, 3 or 4 years now, we've sort of seen tournaments attendance dip, you know, rise based on what we thought, you know, maybe the meta and stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how much people are enjoying the game. But just goes to show that, you know, location convenience is a huge part of tournament attendees as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think location is a big one. I think the meta is in a good enough place that people feel they can bring whatever army they have or whatever army they want to run and still compete. And that really was reflected in kind of, if you looked at the people who were undefeated by round five, we had a mixture of really strange things. We had a great player on Death Guard. There was great Chaos Demons player up there. There was a guy running double Accursed Cultists. There was a Tyranid build up there. And then there was, you know, the usual Necrons and Tau and Sisters, etc. But I liked seeing the big mix of things up there at this tournament. So,
spicy. There we go. Cool. All right. Should we crack it off then? Round one.
You've got
Dark Angels with Toby Bennett.
Yeah, Toby. Toby was an absolute legend. So he was a really cool guy, and he kind of introduced himself, and we had a really, really cool game. Now, I've played Space Marines quite a lot. For some reason, I play Space Marines all the time nowadays, but this was a Firestorm list. Now, me and Dave have some horrible flashbacks to losing to the same Firestorm list in the past. But this Firestorm list was a little bit different. It's kind of halfway between Ironstorm and Firestorm, because it has Azrael in there, which you usually see in Ironstorm. It has loads of Inceptors, which you often see in Vanguard. And then it also has kind of multiple Redemptors and two Gladiator Reapers and a Thunderstrike as well. Mm-hmm. What it doesn't have is kind of the usual Flamers and Melters you'd probably see in a Firestorm list. In fact, I don't think there's a single Flamer in this list.
Yeah, or the Black Templars, and stuff like that.
So while I think Toby was a really good player, I think there's a lot he could do to improve the competitiveness of this list.
Yeah.
So I felt I was going in with a little bit of a list advantage. Now, UKTC has, I would say, the first two rounds are the weakest rounds in the pack. The first one is on Dawn of War, and the Dawn of War format is tough regardless of terrain. Dawn of War just makes things so open because it's really hard to kind of have hidden angles on it.
Yep.
It feels like you're just playing in the open all the way through.
Yeah.
So I knew I was going to get shot, but my sister's list is awesome. So as a quick recap, my sister's list is triple Arcos, so 10 Arcos, and triple Castigator, an Immolator and two Rhinos. We've got a Battle Sister squad, Celestine, the Triumph, and a couple of Crusader squads as well. And then we've got a bunch of Angels. So 3x5 Seraphim, 10 Zephyrim in a big brick, and another 5 Zephyrim. So the list is super, super wide. I know I'm going to lose bits and pieces on my approach turn, but I don't care. I have so much stuff, I'm just going to play the mission. Now, my theory going into most of these games is it's two parts to it. And I think as I went through the tournament, I kind of developed my philosophy a little bit with the list. But the main theory was I'm going to play all my secondaries. That's super easy. My list is so well designed to just score secondaries.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also going to try and deny my opponent's primary. I'm going to try and keep them down to fives, really aggressively push into the bit that they think is safe. So in this map, it's on the right-hand side flank. Your right-hand side flank, your opponent's left-hand side flank. There's a beautiful piece of terrain in the middle of the board where you can dump a load of stuff onto an objective. That's the one that's really hidden. So I put loads of stuff on that side. I was going to chuck Arco Flagellant, Celestine with her Seraphim, everything onto that objective all the way through the game. And I got first turn. I tucked into all the little ruins everywhere. And I threw Celestine and her 5 Seraphim, which were my MVP unit. That unit of Celestine and 5 Flamer Seraphim are beautiful. Tucked them in behind the little wall right next to his objective, which he wanted to move on to. And now that is an absolute pain to deal with. I love that the sisters are so good at allowing the opponent to shoot with one unit in their army. So in this case, maybe he could shoot with like a few little incursors and a scout squad on the side, but he really can't attack Celestine with any more than that. So he decided, look, I've got these two units. I'm going to attack Celestine's unit. He ended up killing one model or something ridiculous, because Celestine's unit is super deceptively tanky. And then now he's just going to lose all of the resources that he wanted to move on to his natural expansion with. And the game kind of went from there with momentum really heavily in my favor. Mm-hmm. His list was cool. I think the Redemptors were okay. Anything with a 2-up armor save is tough to deal with. But as soon as you get 3-up armor save, even vehicles start to die to a lot of the sister's output. So in this case, his 2 Gladiator Reapers really melted very fast. He even tried to rapid ingress one and tank a little bit of shooting from Castigators, but they just absolutely disintegrated. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was round one, and that was 100-47 for me.
Yep.
In this tournament,
yes. I was going to say, yeah, and for context, at 250 players, there's going to be about 8 undefeated or something mm-hmm. like that, 8 or 9 undefeated. So you really need to make sure that you're scoring a huge amount of victory points or not dropping many victory points throughout the course of your run here to make the top to cut 4, which is almost 2 tournaments that get played, isn't there, Vic? Is always how much you can score and rack up points in the 5 rounds. And then the different tournament starts where you're playing more of a true singles tournament, so to speak, aren't you, in the top cut? Mm-hmm.
And sisters are phenomenal at scoring high. Because
yes, you're good.
With some armies, you get the situation where you're like, oh, do I want to really do cleanse and investigate signals here, or do I want to do something with this unit? Sisters don't have that issue because they have so much trash in their army that you are always happy to give stuff. Look, I don't care. I'll cleanse with this. It doesn't matter if it does nothing, because it does nothing even if it tries. So it's fine.
So round two, you're on 100 points so far, and you've got Grey Knights, the dreaded Land Raider Redeemer.
I have got a Land Raider Redeemer on this one, yeah. Only three Dread Knights, which is quite nice. He did have 3 Terminator units as well, so he's got lots of OC, lots of ability to play the mission. This one is supply drop, so this is the one where the objectives start disappearing in the game, and you can get a big swing if you go second onto the last objective. Now, my plan here, and actually, interestingly, the second part of my philosophy developing here was that in 10th edition in general, and probably a reason why I've struggled a little bit with singles in 10th edition, like it hasn't felt natural to me, is if I look at the last two editions, Dave, there was a lot of benefit to playing extremely passively. Hiding behind a wall, counting out your score, you know, playing that thing where you need three of your most expensive units to survive at the end, etc., denying your opponent kills, all this stuff. And you can play a very passive, cagey game where you end the game with most of your resources intact. In 10th edition, I feel like there's a lot of benefit to using your resources. So getting to turn five, having used up all of your resources to play the game, and playing much more aggressively in order to achieve that. So I was trying to do that with the sisters here. I was trying to kind of throw so much stuff at them that, sure, they're dealing with everything that's put in front of them, but by the time they actually break through and start to kind of win the momentum, it's turn five. The game's only five turns. You can't catch up at this point.
And I find that on UKTC, it feels almost a little bit shorter because turn one, you're very unlikely to connect into much of your opponent's army. And then so really you're kind of playing that four-turn game, actually. And if you stumble even for a second and your opponent is being able to flip your primary, for example, then there's almost no way of coming back.
Yeah, absolutely. So this whole tournament, I think every single game I played way more aggressive than I normally do. It was a very, very aggressive play. And it felt good. It felt really good. So Alan, lovely guy, had a great game, and he kind of came in and attacked me a little bit. And I just saw like one or two moments where it was like, okay, he's kind of left this here. I'm just going to chuck half my army at it. And then now my half my army has killed this one little resource. And now I exist in this space. And then rinse and repeat all the way through. Now, unfortunately, this mission, playing against Grey Knights, have an incredible ability to deny your primary. You don't score anything on your home objective in supply drop. You only score it on no man's land objectives. So it's very easy to get dropped down on the primary and never be able to max it out. So the best I could achieve here was an 86-59 win. So I dropped 14 points. And ideally, I'm aiming to drop an average of 5 points per round. So I'm in a little bit of trouble with trying to make the top cut here, but it's okay. It's okay.
Round three against a Mr. Daniel Latham playing Ultramarines, who I believe is playing the John Lennon style Ultramarines list that has now swapped out Eradicators for Aggressors for Eradicators, so to speak.
Absolutely. Did you play against Daniel? Have you played against him before?
I think I have played against him, yes. In the Manchester round, I think, potentially,
He is such a cool guy, Dave. His custom chapter is called the Pink Penetrators. He gave me a Pink Penetrator dice. It's this tiny, the tiniest little pink dice that you've ever seen. And he was cracking me up all game. We had a really good tactical game. And I find that Purge the Foe is probably one of the hardest missions for sisters to play. So this was the one where I was really hoping, please don't let me hit Guard. Guard was so popular at this one. Don't let me hit Custodes. There are a million Custodes players here.
And Necrons is difficult as well, potentially.
Oh, Necrons is difficult as well. And I kind of ended up somewhere between happy and sad here because I think the Vanguard list is hard to get to grips with as well. So this one was going to be a little bit of a challenge. Now, I haven't played against John Lennon's Vanguard list. And all I've seen is it played on stream. And that list is good, isn't it?
It's quite good, yeah.
It's really good.
The thing about this list is that people commonly get wrong is that I think this is one of the best lists in the game. If your Centurion devs, if you go second and your Cent devs can shoot for five turns because they deal insane damage. Like, they've got like five twin las cannons and then five grenade launchers that have D3 blast shots. So it's like, shoot one way, shoot the other way, and oh my word, if you can shoot consistently with this unit, you destroy people. Like, it's perfect against sisters, for example, because the grenades just go at the arcos, and then the twin las cannons go at maybe like a triumph or you know, castigators or something like that, right?
Yep, and he was explaining all of his rules to me because I didn't know them very well. Yep. And he, I asked him, oh, I can see some last cannons on the Centurion Devastators. How many do they have each? He explained to me, you know, he explained, etc. And then he was just about to say, oh yeah, they have some like missile launchers as well.
Yeah.
And before he could explain, the prof was like, oh yeah, that's cool. We'll find out in the game. And then he started shooting them with some Arco flagellants. And I was like, oh yeah, they're the Arcos are T3, so you're probably wounding on threes there. And then he's like, no, they're strength 9. I was like, what? and then it's like, okay, do I like, are they AP 0? Nope, they're AP 2. Okay, cool, all right, I'm gonna do my field of pains. And he was, yeah, like, oh, they're D3 damage each. What? Yeah. Like, and it's like a million shots as well.
Yeah. And he's like, yeah, they hit on like twos rolling ones and everything. You're like, oh, all right, these things cook. Yeah, they're really good. He's also got the Inceptors with bolters as well. I mean, I know they're expensive, but man, I feel like that could do a number on Sisters as well.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I think he had 6 Inceptors with bolters, 6 with, yep, plasma, and another little 3 with plasma.
Yes.
The game ended up being extremely cagey. Now, I had the fortune of going 2nd in this game.
Nice.
And Daniel, while being a very, very competent player, he was... he could have denied me my kill primaries. Okay. I think there were 2 turns in this game where he fed me a single unit with him not having killed a single unit.
I see, yeah.
Or something like that. Sometimes he like killed a single unit and then fed me 2 units.
Yeah, because if you think about it, the Centurion Divs are actually excellent on that mission because you have 2 plus save and Armor of Contempt, which is, I'm assuming, a nightmare for your army to get through in either shooting or combat. So... if you, yep, could just teleport them around and get kill one with them consistently.
Yeah, he killed... I killed 0 Centurion Devastators this game, and he shot them for 4 turns.
Yeah.
So he got massive value, but that was the only thing left in his army by the end of the game. Yeah,
exactly.
There was
commonly when you play against this type of list too, you need to make the decision of whether or not you're going to try and kill that unit. Mm-hmm. And because oftentimes if you do go into it, you kill like 2, it's like, great. You could have killed potentially 3 small units. So it's always a decision point at that point, eh?
This game was actually a little dicey at one point because I made the decision to break the stalemate when I saw a little opportunity to get the forward position and kill something. So I basically put like a huge chunk of my army out, except for the shooty tank elements. And I managed to kill lots of stuff. But then on his turn, he killed 8 units. And then he killed them, but it was like perfect. Everything worked out perfectly for him. And I was like, oh, you know what? Maybe I lost a bit too many resources there. Like I wasn't expecting to lose so much because I had kind of tucked things in so he couldn't activate with everything, but he did activate with what he needed. But then on my clapback, it was tight because I like did all these measurements and everything. I picked up Assassinate and I managed to strat reserve a Castigator into his backfield, so behind him. And I had 10 Arco Flagellants come in and they had like a 9-inch charge over to his Uriel Ventress unit on his home objective. And then I had scraps left to kill his Inceptors that had appeared all over my deployment zone. And Celestine decided not to get back up as well, which was a bit rude of her. So I added everything up and I was like, there is so much margin for error here. And the first dice I roll was a Castigator into 6 Inceptors, and I one-tapped the whole unit.
Got him.
Got him.
I was just about to say, the benefit is Castigators do line up really good against Inceptors, yeah. Probably where you want to save the Armor of Contempt for, I would assume.
Yeah, yeah. So he, he did an Armor of Contempt that one. I had targets like all over the place. So he was like, okay, your first one, fine. Let's see what happens and then go from there. Yeah. And I just one-tapped them. And as soon as you get one little swing like that, everything else becomes easier from there.
Yeah. Castigator, yeah. 150 points, picking up a whole 260 point unit, right?
Exactly. The 10 Arcos exactly killed Uriel Ventress's unit. The Castigator killed the Caldus Assassin for Assassinate. And I managed to clear every Inceptor on the board and also get into Kalgar's unit. And just we were stuck for the whole game, basically. Kalgar's unit plus versus the Triumph and lots of little scraps with Suffering and Sacrifice and etc. I managed to get a 90-72 win there against the Vanguard Marines. Nice. Almost definitely thanks to going 2nd in that game.
Yeah, going 2nd can be very big on that one. So the day concludes. You've dropped...
I've dropped 24 points. It's a lot.
Yeah, 24 is quite a lot because you had, 24 points. And then so going into day two, you're going to be needing to hit some big numbers here. Pairings come out and you've got Necrons, but this is a bit of a, I think if your opponent's first round list was a bit suboptimal, this is probably falling in that category, perhaps.
Yeah, so this is interesting. This is Mark, very similar to Mark Crumbleholm's list.
Yes.
Yeah. And Mark actually thinks that this list is very good into Sisters.
Okay.
With the higher number, with the destroyers and then the heavy destroyers with the anti-infantry guns.
Right, yeah.
For reference,
this list is a Hypercrypt Legion.
Oh, yes.
With, Nightbringer, Void Dragon, two Locust Lords, a unit of six Wraiths Technomancer, five Immortals with a Chronomancer, one unit of Scarabs, one unit of Deathmarks, a big unit of 10 Flayed Ones, one unit of big, like six Locust Destroyers, two units of Heavy Destroyers, and one unit of Tomb Blades. So, and he does have the anti-infantry, anti-tank split on the Locust Heavy Destroyers, yeah.
So in this game, I think the most important unit he has is that anti-infantry heavy destroyer unit.
Yes.
Because there's a good chance that could come up and kill multiple of my units at the same time. Now, we were deploying everything, and he was like really cool guy, and we were doing a lot of stuff by intent. And then he was deploying all his stuff, and his units are so big, they take up so much space, that he kind of deployed most of it. And then he got to his heavy destroyers, the anti-infantry heavy destroyers. And then he realized he just had nowhere he could deploy them that was safe. Like, I would always be able to draw a line because I just had my castigator in my hand just waiting for where he was going to put that unit down. Mm-hmm. So he deployed them, and we both agreed, like, in this position, there's a line going from X point to him.
Yeah.
And so he allowed me to get that. So I had a castigator and an immolator able to shoot its hunter killer missile into these three heavy destroyers, and I one-tapped them by going first in the game.
Okay.
So he started this game now down the best unit in his army against me.
Yeah,
and it was really downhill for him from there, because as soon as that unit is gone, there is nothing in his list that can deal with 30 arcoflagellants running at him.
No, the Catan line up very poorly there, and the Flayed Ones, even though they have a high weight of attacks, they generally speaking probably only kill at 4 or 5 arcoflagellants and get one tapped backwards.
Yeah, exactly. So his army really just melted there. Like, I just put my whole army forward and just ran at him as soon as that one unit had died.
Nice.
I made contact with the Wraiths, ground them down over a few turns. The Catan joined the fight. It got slapped by some arcoflagellants. and then the Void Dragon was left at the end of the game just wandering around.
Nice. So clean one.
100 to 41 in that one. So I got the 100, which was very helpful.
And then you have Tau, Mr. James Hobbs, who I played at the South Coast Supermajor semis and Top Cut, I believe.
Yes.
He's got a bit of an interesting Taulus, and I thought this at the time. He's playing two commanders, and he's got three units of two broadsides, which is interesting. Very weird. Two Ghost Steel. Three units of Tetras, because, you know, why not? Two Vespids, and three Vespids, sorry. He's got his, you know, six column presses.
And the big brackets, of course.
So, what did you think about this list? I thought the broadsides, when I played against them, were a little bit underwhelming, personally.
Yeah, I mean, the broadsides straight up kill my vehicles. So I've got to be a little bit careful of the lines that they draw. Now, James is one of the Vanguard Tactics guys. I think he does the coaching for their Tau. So he's a good player. But he deployed his broadsides first. So he had one in strat reserves, and then he deployed two of the broadside units.
Yeah.
And then they only move 5 inches.
Yeah, they're very mappable once you put them down.
So I just put a dice at 5 inches and looked at the line. And then that line, as long as I'm not on that line, I was able to deploy on the line with my Immolator with five Battle Sisters. And I had a Rhino Crossfield on this map, the quarters. There is a Crossfield line to your kind of left-hand side of your board, Ruin. But I was able to put a Rhino right up on the line, which is really helpful for me. So I had a big momentum advantage just by being able to deploy on the line. I went first in this one and then just moved forward, got my Battle Sisters out, killed a Fireside Marksman that was forward, and that's it. At this point now, I have 10 primary for the entire game.
Very hard for him to subsequently stop you from denying his primary. If you've only got ghost kills and nothing to truly ring an objective against your army, then It's very hard to hold it, isn't it?
Yep. And then I just played all the way across the sides of the board, and I'd screened everything out on my turn two up to the corner of his deployment zone.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, he'd just have to come in. Oh, now this takes me back to that very first game, Dave. I remember what happened in the first game. I screened out the entire board and his reserves died.
Oh, yeah.
This one wasn't quite so bad. But I did manage to push his crisis suit unit really far back, kind of behind his big L almost in his deployment zone.
Nice.
He couldn't dig himself out of it, James. And he resigned about turn three here. And we talked out the points. And in this case, I went fixed. So deploy teleport homers and bring it down. And my first turn, I got a 3 on that for the center. And then the second turn, I got a 4 in this deployment zone. So the maximum score I could get was 99 in this game.
Nice. So that concludes all 5 rounds. Now, I'm just bringing up the placings here on BCP.
Yeah.
I did think it was quite interesting, actually, how we had... 3 draws in the top cut there. So 3 players getting draws in the game. I believe Samuel Smith and Jonathan Partridge played against each other in round 5 at a 79-79 draw.
Yeah, you know Samuel Smith with the Chaos Space Marines, this was a very fascinating list because this was a double accursed cultist brick list.
Oh, interesting, yeah.
And it ran into Dan Whitaker from Dice Down.
Yep.
On round 1, and it managed to beat Dan as well. So.
Yep. Hence being Eldari, right?
Yeah. So,
got him.
So, yeah, it's
rough.
He did extremely well. I think he hit another really good player as well. So, fair play to Sam with that.
He's got, if you're curious about the list, or if you're a CSM listener and you're like, oh, okay, that sounds interesting. 2 dark two bricks of ACDCs, 1 cultist mob, 1 unit of possessed, 5 man possessed, 2 units of 5 warp talons. You know, Chaos Spikers, 2 Predator Destructors, 1 Forge Fiend, even at 200, wow. 2 Nurglings, a Rotigus, and a War Dog Brigand.
Yeah, apparently Rotigus was the MVP in this tournament. Because he like halves the OC of everyone around him, all the enemies. So apparently on that supply drop mission, he just existed on the last objective. So fair play.
480 points of allies.
Oh, yes.
There we go.
But yeah, so in the undefeated bracket, we had obviously that CSM list. We had the Tyranids list you just mentioned. Yes. We had a Necrons, Adeptus Custodes, and Greg Chamberlain just missed out with the Leagues of OTAN. He has been undefeated so many times and missed the top cut. Oh, so
brutal.
I feel for Greg. Yeah.
Well, out to Greg then. Greg, if you're listening, shout out to Greg because he obviously comes to so many tournaments and not making the top cut can be a bit of a pain in the ass sometimes. I know for me as well, personally.
He was 2 points short of Kyle Grundy, who made it into the cut.
The irony of that, at Manchester when I played last month, Kyle Grundy was pipped by 1 point by the admin player. So I think Kyle, at least getting his just desserts there in this tournament. So there we go. That's the top cut. The top cut, I'll just go through the undefeated because I think that's quite interesting. Look who was attending in the meta. Obviously, we had Yuan Sisters, Nassim on Astra Militarum, Sam Nash from Triad Wargaming, I think in his first top cut, which is awesome. Super lovely guy playing Astra Militarum, or Guard, I'll call it. Kyle on Tau, Greg on Leagues of OTAN, Ashley Brown on Adeptus Custodes, Jonathan Partridge on Tyranids, Ben Piddington on Necrons, and Samuel Smith on Chaos Space Marines. And that rounds out the undefeated. Then we also had Jack Tite and Stephen Box also on Sisters. So I think actually if you look at it, Sisters are one of the most popular armies in this top 10.
Oh yeah, definitely. There's 3 Sisters. No, I mean Boxy's just outside of the top 10. But I think in the top 10, there's the 2 Guard, isn't it? That's the most popular one. In the top 15 or so.
Yes, yeah.
Top 15, there's 2 Sisters players, which is great. Yes.
Yeah. So interesting. 3-3. Development. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Really so the round starts, for those of you who have not been involved in the top cut at UKTC, usually the games, your round 5 finishes at 4:30, and then you're shuffled on right to start playing as soon as possible. So if you do need to play a long finals game, it's not going to be 11:30 when you finish.
Yeah.
So you're up against Kyle Grundy on Tau Empire. Now, I think... It's difficult to say, but is this the pairing that you probably wanted, I think, for this top?
Yeah, so in this mission, it's Hammer and Anvil. and taken hold. Yes. And I really didn't want to play Guard on Hammer and Anvil, to be honest.
It is very good for Guard, in my experience.
Yeah, so I think I was very lucky to hit this. I had the highest score going into the cut, and Kyle came in fourth. Yeah. So one and four gets paired. So I was lucky to dodge the two Guard players. But yeah. I actually kind of, I thought I was going to play one of the Guard players until the other top cut, the other kind of round five one went to a draw.
Yes.
And then it mixed things up, and I was messaging Dave. That's when I messaged you, and I was like, Dave, I'm fine. It's going to be something else.
Yeah. Although I think, if I'm being honest, Sam and Nassim's list could have taken more advantage of this mission. But, you know, that's a very fine point anyway. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Tau game, how does this go? Because this one, we were texting on our team chat. I was like, oh, what's the update? Because it was like 8 o'clock, and I was like, well, you guys should be basically done now. But I will say Kyle is a little bit notorious for taking for having longish games.
Yep.
But this one goes right down to the wire by the looks of it.
This one was extremely challenging based on list, to be honest, Dave. Because actually, triple Ghost Keel and triple Riptide is very tough for Sisters to deal with. It's all 2+ armor saves. Mm-hmm.
Lone Op as well, so you can't actually shoot the ghost skills very easily with say Castigators, for example, right?
Yeah, so I knew I was going to have a little bit of a challenge because all of his stuff can clear my units, you know, even a ghost skill shooting if it's guided will clear my units. Mm-hmm. And because he cut out a lot of stuff, like he has like no Tetras in his list, he has no Crisis Suits in his list, he only has a single commander. His list is so incredibly lean here. Mm-hmm. Lots of SMS coming out of the hammerheads and things. He has anti-tank, anti-infantry, lots of board presence, and I can't kill him. So I'm obviously not going to tell Kyle this. I'm going to go in with all the cocky confidence I have. And we're kind of deploying and playing this very tactical game. And I managed to get a big advantage going early on in the game. So this game, my dice completely left me, Dave.
Did you go first or second? Because I feel like you want to go first here, for sure.
Yeah, so I went first in this game.
Cool, nice.
So I approached onto my natural objective. He left me a line going into his Devilfish. I shot a bunch of like Hunter Killers and stuff. I managed to get three things through. I did 3 damage, classic, usual, you know, the 3d6 damages, whatever. I even used a CP reroll on the middle one because... I could have kind of tweaked things around because it was left on 7 wounds after all the other guns had gone into it. It's like, okay, cool. It would be nice to get a first turn kill, but it's fine. It wasn't meant to be. I approached, moved everything here and there, measured out all of Kyle's different threat ranges, managed to get Celestine, who was, again, MVP, right into the middle, tucked in behind the UKTC ruin, where she fits perfectly.
And for those that haven't played this particular mission, it's supply drop, hidden supply drop. So there's actually 4 objectives in the middle of the board.
Yeah, hidden supplies.
So if you've got stuff in your middle objective ruin, if you've got stuff in the small ruin in the middle of the board, it can't hold an objective while being in the ruin, but it's like a 2-inch walk to get to any of the other objectives, basically. So once you've got something in there, it's coming out next turn, guaranteed.
Definitely. And if he chose to shot any SMS at all into Celestine's unit, I would have been able to regen a model into onto the objective and score extra primary. Any extra primary in this one is huge. Now, I hit really good cards. First turn, extend battle lines, secure no man's land was easy. Glorious. And then I managed to also play into getting 10 primaries all the way through.
Wow.
While Kyle was only getting 5s. Okay. Because I super stacked one flank and just focused on primary denial on the other side.
Yeah.
Kyle is notorious as being an extremely defensive player. So I had this feeling in my mind that he wouldn't just rush me when maybe he could have been a little bit more aggressive with his 2+ armor save assets.
Yeah.
Because if he just thrown them at me, sure, I would have done a bit of damage, maybe killed one. But I'm not really killing more than one with the kind of army that I have.
He would have held his primary probably a bit better then.
Definitely. Him not being able to hold primary meant that going into turn 4, round 4, I had about a 25, 27 point advantage on him.
Right.
I ended up, so the big drama in this game was the clock. Me and Kyle always have issues with the clock when we play. Mm-hmm. And Kyle was left with, I think, 8 minutes on his clock.
Yep.
And I clocked out.
Okay.
And this was on the top of turn 4. So Kyle has his turn 4 and turn 5, and Kyle decides to go for the death clock, the hard clocking.
Sure.
He was a big distance behind me, but so we clocked out, and I agreed to it. I said, yeah, of course, your choice, whatever. And then he asked me, do you mind if we talk out the game here? And I said, absolutely not. Play the game. And he played the game and went through it, because I wanted to see if he can get 27 points here. Great. You know,
you can. If your opponent cannot play the game, you can get 27 points in 2 turns. Like,
yeah, so he could do that. So then he played it out. He got a few points here and there. He drew capture enemy outpost on his turn. And because he was in such a rush to play, because he only had a few seconds left, he didn't kill one of my units that was just happily sitting on primary. So on my turn 5, I got 10 on primary again, Dave.
Right.
So now he's looking for 37 points to try and catch up to me. And he hit capture enemy outpost. He tried one or two little tricks to try and get it. There was no way he was going to get it. He clocked out and the judge told us to stop. And he was short by a few points there. He was short by 7 points. He got 73 versus my 80 points that I had. Yeah. I got to 80 in 4 turns.
Is that without you doing secondaries on turn 5, basically?
Yeah, I drew my secondaries and I couldn't do any of them without doing anything. But you know, Dave, like, you have to roll your saves and stuff when you're clocked out, but you're not allowed to sub in a miracle dice. So he just hit me with a railgun for no prisoners. That would have really messed him up if he hadn't got that. And I said, okay, I'm just going to use the 6. And the judge said, you can't make any decisions. You just have to just roll dice.
Oh dear.
Yeah, that's funny. I've never been clocked out before. That's the first time. It was such a weird experience to see someone play 2 turns and not be able to do anything.
Yeah, I've never been clocked out before either, but I think I've always been up on the time in terms of the time. But it's an interesting one, isn't it? The clock is the eternal debate throughout Warhammer, isn't it?
I don't mind it. I think it was a good lesson for me to learn, you know, because there was, I think, my turn 4 or turn 3, one of them, I kind of like was really trying to work out how can I attack Kyle and do any damage here.
Yeah.
And I kind of put some stuff out and it did no damage. And I would have been much better off just not trying to shoot him and just like existing in spaces and playing the mission once I was so far ahead.
Yep.
I could have literally played my turn 3 and 4 in like 2 minutes if I just moved models.
Yeah, just move models. That's actually how I played against Tau as well when I played James, I think it was. I didn't even charge or anything. I just put my casket on objectives, melted my unit, threw a grenade, and passed the turn. I was like, okay, throw some indirect, but you know, I'm going to deny you primary. I'm holding this thing with my Borgrin, and then I'll just slowly melt mine your ghost kills away eventually, mate. Interesting one. I think, by the way, just for clarification here, mm-hmm. like the whole clock situation, I think Vic and I probably will both want to make it clear that it's in everyone's right to enforce the clock as well. And for a large part, the game would probably be a lot healthier if people enforce the clock as a standing rule as well, rather than it be kind of this gray area. So nothing against Kyle or the judges for enforcing
the clock. I have nothing against Kyle. And in fact, I kind of respect him just going for it and just playing for the win there on the clock. What was very interesting about this game was, you know, Kyle is a super kind of high energy guy. He's got so mm-hmm. much energy. He's very passionate about everything he does. Very good mentality as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of the opposite. I'm very kind of like cool. I'll crack loads of jokes, but it'll be kind of dry humor. Right. And the contrast between us was quite interesting. And I think a lot of the spectators enjoyed that interaction between us.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the experience of playing in these kinds of finals and semifinals did show through a little bit.
Yeah.
And like there was a big moment where in all my games, when it comes to cock dice, Dave, it's been a while since I played you in a real board, but I always say, because I'm a relatively slow player for speed, if I can see what the face is, it doesn't matter. I'm just going to take the dice of whatever face it is, good or bad. Sure. And I'm not going to re-roll it. Because I know some people, even if it's slightly raised, they'll re-roll the dice.
That's what I do, yeah. I always say to my opponent beforehand, look, if anything's not completely flat, I just re-roll it.
Everyone knows that. And in this game, I had been kind of following that all the way through. And there was a moment where like a dice landed and it was slightly cocked and it was a 6 on a railgun save.
Right.
And Kyle said, you have to reroll that. And I said, absolutely not. And, and you know, there's no way I'm going to be pushed to do something that I don't want to do at this stage of my experience. And, you know, being stern and clear, especially when you're in these high intensity games, is really important. And you can laugh it off with a joke afterwards, but you can't let people, you can't fall into other people's energy. You have to stay in your own energy, in your own bubble when you're playing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can go on a big tangent about this one for sure, of course. You know, yeah, I think, you know, I've never let people bully me around the board as well. And there's been, you know, there's been a lot of years, especially when I first started playing the game. But in addition to that, I think when you are, when you're someone who consistently gets to top cuts, you know, consistently playing in finals, you'll find the people that usually do that, of course, are people that can make your opponent kind of bend to their will, so to speak, isn't it? You know, like, you know, you're playing against someone that will, like, will play and execute things that you're not aware of or do, you know what I mean? It's like, it's kind of like, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I used to always, like, look at some people and think, like, man, you know, they just, like, what they're doing is so powerful, the way that they play, you know, and I think that's characteristic of people that you see are doing very well consistently at tournaments. And people that just miss the mark, I think, are missing that kind of X factor of, like, either giving too much information away or not not having the game plan, or like that killer instinct game plan, or being able to see the game five turns in advance, you know, so to speak, right? So people have got different abilities in that sense, right? Some people are really good at knowing where the game needs to be in turn four and five, etc. Some people are really good at math. Some people are really good at list building. But it's always interesting when you look at the top people, like how you see them carry themselves is one thing. You know, Manny Chima is a big thinker in a lot of ways, right? Like, he'll take a lot of time on turns one, turns two, pre-game, but then he'll speed up very, very fast. And I always thought that, and he'll always be on the points as well. But he'll speed up a lot towards the latter part there as well. So that I kind of learned a lesson from that too, is that, you know, ones and twos is the most critical kind of part, and it's okay to take time and making sure those early turns are executed well.
Yeah, and I have to give a lot of props to Kyle after this, because he took this game very gracefully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, always positive. Yeah.
Like, an extremely positive mentality to the way he learns from these things. Like, I read his little write-up. We had a little Team England write-up, and it was so incredibly, like, insightful and positive. So props to Kyle for that, because I did put him under a lot of pressure in this game. Mm-hmm. Like, really keeping a close eye on his measurements and his movements, because there were so many important moments where if he just goes a little bit further, it's not going to work out. Making sure he's actually shooting the correct profiles and we're catching each other. Of course, he kept me to the same standards as well. There was a moment where I had a very important charge to make, and it was just a hair outside 8 inches. I rolled the 8 on the charge, and he kept me very honest and said, like, he like double, triple checked it and said, nope, it's out. And it's fair. It's correct.
Yeah, completely fair. Absolutely, completely. And it's all like, it's completely okay to play hard and still be friendly. Like, this, and that's the best way to play, I think, as well, right? Is to play hard but friendly as well.
Yep. Props to Kyle. He ended up in fourth place here. And Nas in the other game had the Astra Militara mirror match. And Nas got to go first. So, the big advantage in that one.
Usually helps, yeah. I think this team had a bit of a list advantage in that one as well, to be fair. Sam had a bit more tech pieces, the kind of secondary Chimera and stuff like that, whereas on this mission where it's hammer and anvil, you just want to have a lot of downstream shooting and thickness as well. Nice. So your game goes like well into 3 hours, obviously, and then you're boom straight onto second game. I guess Nassim and Sam's game wrapped up reasonably quickly.
Yeah, my models were a mess here, Dave. I'm literally, my stuff was all over the place, and I was going straight from taking my models on one table and deploying them on another table.
Yeah, for sure.
Like running between the tables, deploying like that. So I'm playing Nas in the finals here. I love Nas. He's like one of my favorite people in 40K. He's my roommate at WTC, and he's my Team England teammate. And Nas was playing Astra Militara. I don't know, is this list interesting to you, Dave? What do you think?
It depends what you mean by interesting, I think. it's 18 Bulgrin, yes. and 2 Manticores. 18 Bulgrin, 2 Manticores, only 20 Kaskin. I guess that's a choice. I'm saying these things, but I'm the one taking the weirdest stuff with Guard. So, you know, take it with a grain of salt, right? It's a very good list, of course. Yes. It's got a Basilisk, one Basilisk, so it's a 2 two Manticore, one Basilisk split, 18 Borgrin, 20 Kaskin. And the way you fit in 18 Borgrin here, I'm assuming, is you don't play a Chimera. You only play one Scout Sentinel, and you cut a Kaskin unit. So that's how you fit like the extra nine that my kind of list has above it. Mm-hmm. And then he's got two tank commanders, both the plasmas, etc. Platoon command squad, and Ursula Creed. And yeah, I guess if you know if you're playing 18 Borgrin, you kind of want a platoon command squad. I'd probably play it at that point, but I wouldn't play 18 Borgrin to begin with.
Yep. And like when I got to this table, Nass had obviously because his game finished in half an hour, Dave.
Right. Yeah.
So Nass had 2.5 hours to plan his deployment. Like here, so he was so like clear with it. Like my units, my two tank. He deployed both tank commanders on the board, which I found strange. Because I would probably expect one to go in strat reserve here.
Yes, or redeploy into strat reserve is usually the one. Yeah.
Right, to keep me under pressure. And yeah. So he set up these two tank commanders, and they were in these positions where they could...
For reference, the mission is Crucible of Battle and Priority Targets.
Priority targets, yes.
So if you hold two objectives for 5 turns, you will get 50 primary, basically. So the way that I look at this when I play Josh as well, a lot of it is on the cards, especially if both players hunker down, make sure their primary can't get hit, and then play the cards that way. But you guys obviously had a very different game as well, so I'll let you...
No problem. Well, he's got these two tank commanders deployed in such a way that they could both kind of... they can both shoot a flank, one each, but both of them can shoot down the middle together. So he has these set up in some fancy position that he likes. Sure. And then he's got his 18 Borgrin that they're all deployed on the board. And very interestingly, there's a big dead open space in UKTC on this this map. In front of your large home ruin, there's a lot of dead space. And he deployed a unit of 6 Borgrin on the line in that spot because I put 2 Castigators in strat reserve, so I didn't really have much I could attack him with.
Okay, yeah.
And these 6 Borgrin are able to move, and attack my safe objective. Now, it's actually quite an interesting game because I think it's very, very passive. Like you said, if he's not able to attack that home objective.
Yeah.
And then it's just down to the cards.
Yeah.
And I'd argue I'd feel quite comfortable plus playing it on the cards.
For sure.
To be honest.
So I did a big write-up for Vic and was like, this is how you want to play it, you know, blah, blah, blah. You've got a huge card advantage. Play it, lock for 50 primary. If you get an opportunity to hit him down the thing, he'll go 45 primary and, you know, et cetera.
Yeah, but I was very sloppy. When I deployed my army, I just was grabbing whatever I could and trying to deploy it in a nice place. But not ideal for finals against a really good player, but it is what it is. And I had to correct my mistakes as I went along. Now, I got about 90% of it correct, though. Which was good. But on my home objective, Dave, I only deployed a split unit of 5 Battle Sisters.
Oof.
I had my turn 1 and I moved, I left only the 5 Sisters on there. I moved, shot his Borgrin, killed one of them, and then just set up in positions. I put my Castigator a hair off the objective because I'm an idiot. So now on his turn, Nass kind of charges me with these Borgrin, shoots one or two little bits, and manages to steal my expansion objective off me. And then he shoots his indirect on my 5 Sisters on my home objective, and he kills that. He gets better cards than me on turn 1, so now I've got a 0 primary going into turn 2, and he's ahead of me on the points. So he's already 20 points ahead. And I know he's going to max out his primary if I don't do anything.
Yeah.
So this is disaster territory, right?
I was always curious, like, how does he steal your objective with 5 OC of Borgrin? Like, do you not just put like 10 Arco Fledges on that point?
No, I didn't disembark them because in my head, I hadn't even got that he's going to kill those 5 Sisters. Obviously, if I had, I would have avoided it, right?
No, in I mean my head, your homework, your side objective.
Yes, but in my head, I had that these 5 Sisters aren't going to die. It's not a problem. So if I put 10 Arcos out, all his indirect goes into it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was like, let me preserve the Arcos here, because without the Arco Flagellus, I'm not going to get through these Borgrin.
Yeah.
So I had just an Immolator and a Rhino on top of that objective.
Oh, okay.
Along with like a unit of Angel, so a unit of Zephyrim there.
Okay, yeah.
So I thought, okay, it should be fine. Like, maybe it'll be okay here if I just ring the thing so he can't get his Borgrin in.
Yeah.
I should be okay. But then for some reason, I was so tired and confused, I just completely forgot about the indirect existing apart from keeping my Arcos alive. Right. I was like, indirect can only shoot Arcos, right? No, they can shoot anything they want.
I mean, but it's also easy to like hone in on, be like, okay, the indirect is so good into the Arcos, stuff like that, you know, and then just be like, oh, you've completely missed something across the other side of the board, right? Like,
exactly.
That just happens, right? I mean, you're playing, this is the fourth round of the day and it's starting at 8 o'clock at night, right?
So. Yeah. So Nas obviously gets a superb like turn. Turn one, where he goes in, the he kills the five sisters, manages to clear a space with the indirect for his Bulgrin to charge into my natural expansion objective, gets on there, tags loads of stuff up, and he out OCs me on that. So fair play to me, put me down to zero. And now at this point, I was waking up a little bit, Dave. I was starting to get my energy back, starting to get back into the flow of the game. I was like, okay, how are we going to fix this? I've gone first so I can get my reserves, and I put a huge amount of stuff in reserves. 2 Castigators, 10 Arcoflagellants, a big brick of Zephyrim. And here I found all my solutions to my problems. And these were the problems and these were the solutions. The first is...
Limitless Charges.
Yeah. So the first one is I can't let him zero me on primary again. From now on, I have to be scoring 10s on primaries. So my 10 Zephyrim deep struck onto my home objective.
Yep.
Then my Castigator towed onto the home objective. So now I have home objective secured. Next thing is, how do I deal with these Bulgrin in front of my face? So my other 2 Castigators come out of Strat Reserve on the right flank. So this flank is nearest his safe objective.
Yeah.
And my plan is these Castigators are going to shoot cross field all game, or as long as they're alive. And they're also going to jump onto his home objective and get their 6 OC on there.
Mm-hmm.
I end up getting, they end up being absolute MVPs for me in this game, because he really struggles to deal with them. And Celestine's unit gets thrown down the same flank as well. The 10 Arcoflagellants come in out of Strat Reserves and set up a 9-inch charge into his Catachans and his Bulgrin on his natural expansion objective. I also hit Tempting Target on my cards, which is on that objective. Nas puts it on.
Yeah.
He has a middle unit of Bulgrins. He's tagged up my Rhino with his other little Bulgrin unit. The Rhino, what's inside of it, I kind of screened it with a little Seraphim unit so that I always have space to disembark.
Yep.
And I get my Arcoflagellants out, run them across the board. I have a 9-inch charge into his Bulgrin in the middle. And then my last unit of Bulgrin, which are in the corner of the board, they jump out and go for a 2-inch charge into his Bulgrin that he's attacked me with. So I've got these 3 charges with 10 Arcos, 10 Arcos, 10 Arcos into his 3 units of Bulgrin set up. One of them is automatic. It's a 2-incher. The other one, I've got a 6 on the Miracle Dice, and I've got a second 6 on the Miracle Dice. I've got 2. So both of them, I need 3 ups to hit 9-inch charges on both of them. I hit all of the charges, Dave. I get everything transitioned towards the middle of the board. My Castigators are set up so they're shooting crossfield, and I end up killing the 5 Bulgrin that were left attacking my natural expansion objective. In the middle, I ended up killing 4 Bulgrin, and then in the other objective, because it was Celestine's unit and the Arcoflagellants, they ended up killing all of the Bulgrin. So he's left with just 2 Bulgrin here, which is glorious. So. I was very happy with that outcome. I managed to flip his primary so that he was only getting a 5 this turn, which is also absolutely huge.
And then it would be really hard for him to both attack you and secure his other objective, right? So he's probably getting 5s the rest of the game.
Absolutely. At this point, he was stuck. He had no way of attacking and displacing me off his natural expansion objective without me also sending in a second wave into that objective. Because I had the 2 Castigators set up there with their movement enough for me to see around the corner and to see into that objective. Yeah. So he was never able to get more than a 5 for the rest of the game. And while I was dying, my resources were also pinching him down. He made a mistake as well. The 2 Bulgrin he had left in the middle, he fell them back closer towards me, towards the middle, and allowed my Triumph to slingshot into the middle objective.
Oh.
And the Triumph wouldn't have been able to reach anyway. So now I'm on all of the objectives in No Man's Land. And Celestine is going on an absolute tear through his flank, and he just couldn't deal with that.
Your base belongs to me.
Yeah, so poor Nas got stuck, and he couldn't dig himself out of the points deficit he now found himself in, even going second.
But that's kind of the thing with Guard, though. If you allow your opponent to connect a huge amount of their army into you, it's one of the places where you can really get stuck down, though, right?
Yeah,
which is kind of, which makes you wonder if, as weird as it sounds, like, is the correct play? I still don't think the correct play is to give you the second five on your outside objective. I would have just shot the five on the point, on your home point, taken the 5 points and been happy with it, and curled up into the tightest ball possible and ridden the cards out after that. That's just me, though, but I mean, it gets it goes differently.
I think you're right. I think what he should have done was pre-measured a few things here.
Right.
Like, you know, the Bulgrin getting that, the Strat Reserve Arco Flagellant, you're having a 9-inch charge to his Bulgrin. He could have easily made that an 11-inch charge.
Right.
Yeah. And just had the Catachan sitting on the objective, or like the Catachan's really far forward and then a bunch of stuff on that objective.
Yeah, I mean, you've got Catachans, you've got Kaskin, and the Sentinel to screen with at zero cost, with reinforcements being 2 CP.
Yep.
And which is actually kind of good for tactical cards too, because that means that you'll be able to respawn them into a position of doing something. But also, the Castigators, if you play passive, they'll never get a line onto anything that you don't want, because they have to arrive from Strat Reserve, or the only way you can do it is rapid ingress them down a flank and then see into something. You can only ever do that with one Castigator. So it's not exactly as if you can do that with one Castigator. Sure, that's fine. And so, you know, if you accept that that's going to happen, like, one Castigator might spike and maybe kill an indirect piece, maybe, right? But you've got to be really lucky. Other than that, it's, you know, it's terrible at killing basically everything else. So if you just accept that, especially going second as well, that your opponent's reserves have to come in before you as well, then I think playing ultra defensive is the way to play those ones.
Definitely. I think if I could go back around for Nass and for him to do it again, interestingly, it kind of, I liked his play, throwing the Bulgrin in, taking me down to zero. I think that's perfect. Yeah. That's due to my own mistake. But in a way, I think me making those mistakes and being so sloppy may have won me the game. Because I think it made him more relaxed and think that he's just going to smash me now.
Yeah.
And because of that, he felt he didn't have to worry. He can be really aggressive with his other assets.
Yeah, but it's interesting though, isn't it? Because the Bulgrin also, you know, I'm only nitpicking this because obviously I play the army so much, but the Bulgrin also have no shields up when they don't have the 3+ save, and Arcos just absolutely tear through them. So, you know, if you use them defensively, like, you could have, on Crucible of Battle, you can have them on your big L right against the wall there, and that blocks reserves, and they're super resilient from getting shot. And, like, all your reserves have to come in at some point, right? I almost would have just put a tank commander, 10 Kaskin with OC2 and 6 Bulgrin on my on your outside objective, shown almost nothing, indirected the 5 sisters turn 1, tried to do my objectives, and then left everything else there, and probably put a tank commander in outflank. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm only saying that because Josh and I played the same mission twice, back to back, almost the same mission. So that's kind of how both of us changed after playing both each other.
Yeah. I would obviously play a quarter. I think, interestingly, I think sisters have the advantage in that particular mission, regardless of going first.
I think for sure, yeah. Because even if you do play defensive, it's down to the cards, and your army is so much better at executing the cards.
Yeah, just as long as you set up to be able to, let's say, just do assassinate or something, you know, Celestine's units just in a position where you can threaten that. Yeah. I think the cards are just slightly better.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for like investigate signals, homers, stuff like that, you've just got units that can come in and do them as well, from rapid ingress or from wherever. You've got so much chaff, right? You can throw a character away or something, which I think is, it gives you a big advantage in doing those other cards.
I'm also a massive fan of the Castigators triggering Battleshock on guard units. He really struggled to activate reinforcements, actually.
Really?
The amount of Battleshock that was going on from the battle cannons. I think I managed to take out 20 Kazakin without them being able to reinforce. So
it's
really nice.
Pretty sick. I mean, that's one of the downsides of only playing 20 Kazakin, is that, you know, you're not going to, there's no guarantee, unless, you know, I mean, there's no guarantee that you get to play with 2,400 points, although the Castigator is quite a fringe use case, I suppose, right? But forcing Battleshocks can be really good against them because they're usually leadership 7.
There's some really cool tech as well, you know, because there's a character called the Dogmata, who people have written off as being the worst sisters character. She's only 45 points, and she's like basically their chaplain, their priest. But she has a 6-inch aura of -1 leadership for battle shock and leadership checks.
Oh, cool.
And there's a really good enhancement where when a character dies, you get an additional D3 miracle dice. And people have been running other characters for that, which are at 40 points. But for her, at 55 points, 15 points more, you can really synergize into that leadership thing. Because in the game against Kyle, there was a moment where he put these 10 Pathfinders out to do secure no man's land and cleanse two objectives. And he had no other way of getting to it. And I fired Overwatch with my Castigator. I got 8 shots. If any of them had connected, he would have had to take a leadership check. But he got away with it. And if he misses that, he's down 10 secondary points, Dave.
Yeah, that's quite big, isn't it?
So that hug, it's a really powerful mechanic being able to trigger it. And I found doing it on Overwatch was so powerful in this tournament.
And I guess with Overwatch, it's quite cool, isn't it? And the Plagueburst Crawler also has that's another unit that has good access to that as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, it makes me feel like one of my Castigators should maybe have auto cannons. They have rerolls hits against infantry, whereas the battle cannons reroll hits against vehicles. So there are moments where the reroll hits comes up in Overwatch as well.
The battle cannon's pretty spicy though, isn't it?
I've managed to do that. Yeah, I love the battle cannon. Oh, great unit.
Awesome.
But this one ended up with about a 15-point win to the Sisters.
Nice.
And it was glorious.
There we go. It's been a bit of a quiet run for you for like the 10th edition.
I mean, I hit I've hit 5-0 twice.
Yeah.
And 4-1 twice.
Yeah.
And now I've obviously got got the 6-7 wins. I hadn't got 6 wins up to this point in 10th edition. So there I'm happy to do that.
Got him.
Yeah.
Got him. There we go. Nice to see Ignite doing up there.
You know what's interesting, Dave? My record with Sisters, I was looking back at it, is so much better than any of my other armies.
Yeah.
Across these last 3 editions, I played 5 tournaments with Sisters, 2 GTs, 6 tournaments, 2 GTs, 2 majors, and a super major.
Yeah.
And one of the majors was the Bournemouth one where I lost 2 games in that tournament. And then the other 4 tournaments, I've won all of them. So his Sisters have been really successful for me.
I mean, good. That was the last time we played as well, wasn't it?
That was, yeah.
That was the last time we played in real life across the board. And that's when we started the podcast as well. So that's a good note to end it on.
Yes.
There we go. Episode 51 with the new Oxford champ, Big BJ. Feels good to have you back.
Shout out.
Oh, yeah.
Because obviously I haven't gone through all the tiny little tech pieces in the list in this particular one, but I'm doing a podcast with the Sister Act podcast.
Yes, with Mitch.
With Mitch and Scott Ketchum. Cool. And that's obviously Sisters only, so that's going to be really, really detailed on all the little tech pieces I have in my list, because I know a lot of people have been asking about that. So if you do want to leave any questions, there's the Sister Act podcast for that, and their Sister Act Discord. And they have their Patreon where you can ask questions, or you can just wait till the episode comes out.
There we go. Boom. Episode 51. Oh, because I suck at this, do like, comment, and subscribe. And if you do have any questions, drop them for Vic. And also, we're still on track, hopefully, going to be having some points out this week. So,
yes.
I mean, it's sounding like Guard versus Sisters. I mean, you know, come on. I can't let you get away with this one, man.
I feel like you know too much, Dave, but I think we should definitely do that. I didn't
know this to begin with. There we go. Sisters versus Guard, maybe. Or let us know what you think. I've had some requests saying Vic should maybe play Knights.
Yeah.
I think he's great.
That would be the end.
And then me playing Tau, maybe. So we'll see how it goes. It'd be really cool to play some new points on armies I was super familiar with as well, I think. So, yeah.
There we go. Awesome, guys.
Catch you guys at the next one. Have a good one.
See ya.
Thank you for listening to the 40K Fireside Podcast. Vic and I hope you've enjoyed listening, and we greatly appreciate any feedback that you can provide after the show.